Good evening. We're glad that we have the opportunity to come together and worship God. And as we're doing this year, we're emphasizing family on the fourth Sunday night. And tonight we're thinking about a commitment in marriage. There was a couple who were paying for groceries in the checkout line, and they were discussing their soon-to-be 50th wedding anniversary. And the young cashier interjected by saying, "I can't imagine being married to the same man for 50 years. The wife wisely replied, teaching the young girl a lesson. "Well, honey, don't get married until you can." I think there's a lot of wisdom in that line that this older lady was sharing with that younger lady, that we need to have commitment, that you need to enter into marriage with that expectation and that desire that you're going to be committed to them for life. When we think about marriage and commitment, I want to begin by thinking a little bit about this topic in a general sense in our culture. For example, this is the reason in our culture that many people get married even today. I mean, in our culture, you know, people will live together for a certain amount of time often. In fact, we will note that cohabiting has gone up dramatically in the last 20 to 30 years. But still, after a period of often living together, people will say, "You know what, let's get married." And what do they mean by that? They mean that they have this expectation that they're wanting to commit to one another more. It's also the case that many people in TV and entertainment industry and in our culture in general, marriage is seen as a commitment. And so it's ironic that with divorce being so easy that we still have such a prevalence. And so when we think about marriage and commitment, it's the reason that many get married. It's still seen as having more of a commitment. And it's also, therefore, the reason so many are avoiding marriage. All right? It's kind of like that's that jumping off the cliff, the final thing, you get married. You know, it's how it's often portrayed in our culture. And so it's why a lot of people are delaying or not getting married. Cohabiting couples have quadrupled over the last 30 years. Less than half of American households are now married, predominantly throughout our history. We've had a majority of our households have had a married union in them. It's not the case anymore. The married couples, married households are a minority, a little bit below 50%. The trend, says one author, in the last four decades suggests from a study that many adults are less likely to find marriage as an attractive choice. In 1970, 78.6% of adults aged 20 to 54 were married. But in 2008, that had dropped over 20% to 57% in that age range were married. And a lot of people are just avoiding marriage because of the disillusionment with the marriage institution, because of being upset with the divorce and all that has gone on with that in their parents' generation. And a lot of younger people are just, if they're not avoiding marriage, they're at least delaying it. And the age of marriage is getting much older. It's also, I won't say much about this, but it's interesting to me, as I've been talking about our culture, that it's also been a key issue or motivating point in this issue of same-sex marriage. And they say that they need to have marriage because they're a committed relationship. And one thing that I wanted to point out is some people are arguing that if two people are in love and they're, quote, committed to each other, they're committed to one another, then they should have the right to be married. And I want to emphasize as we go through this lesson, just in general, that commitment to one another does not give someone the right to be married, but rather marriage should be defined by God as between a man and a woman. And those who enter in marriage should understand the commitment they're assuming. And so this has also been a key talking point on this issue. Now turn to Ephesians chapter 5. Ephesians chapter 5, 21 through 33. I have kind of, tonight in tonight's lesson, a practical theological section, and then we're going to look to some commitments that we make and some very applicable points for our marriages. And so let's begin by thinking about Ephesians 5, 21 through 33. Paul is writing, and he's illustrating, as we've often studied this text, the relationship between Christ and his church, between a relationship of a groom and his bride. And as you read through this text, beginning in verse 21, submitting to one another in a reverence for Christ, wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church, his body, and is himself its Savior. Now, as the church submits to Christ, so also wives should submit in everything to their husbands. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. So you have this mutual love and respect going back and forth between the husband and the wife, that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, so that he might present the church to himself in splendor, without spot or wrinkle or any such thing, that she might be holy and without blemish. And in the same way, husbands should love their wives. Notice that phrase, in the same way. We are representing to the world the relationship between Christ and his church. Husbands should love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it just as Christ does the church. Because we are members of his body, therefore a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast or cleave unto his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. The mystery is profound. And I'm saying that it refers to Christ and the church. And then he concludes, however, let each one of you love his wife as himself, and let the wife see that she respects her husband. It's not easy to do these two admonitions that Paul requires of us. He requires the husbands to love, to be emotionally attached and be nourishing and cherishing his wife, to treat her as precious and valuable and cherish that union and seek to meet her needs and provide for her in the ways that she needs. And the wife is required in this passage to be respectful and submissive to her husband, to honor him and to love him. And it's not easy for a wife to show him the respect. Sometimes we say, you know, in our culture we say, well, we've got to love them. And even if they don't deserve love, as all of us at times are certainly aren't deserving, but we feel like, well, they've got to love me because they married me, and they've got to love me even if I don't deserve it, right? It's interesting. Lots of times wives, when it comes to respect, will say about that husband, I'm not going to respect him unless he earns that respect or deserves that respect. But no wife wants to have that same thing put upon them regarding love, do we? We want to be loved even whether we deserve it or not. And so Paul is requiring husbands to make sure they love their wives, not based upon whether that wife deserves it or not, but because God commands it. And he's requiring the wife to love and respect her husband, not based upon whether he deserves it per se, but because God has required it. Now, I was reading a book, and it makes the emphasis that we are reflecting Christ. And he made some good questions that I want to read. And from the book Counterculture, talking to men first. If we are harsh to our wives, we will show the world that Christ is cruel to his people. If we ignore our wives, we will show the world that Christ wants nothing to do with his people. If we leave our wives, we will show the world that Christ deserts his people. What pictures are our marriages giving to our culture about Christ's relationship with the church? Now, I liked what he did here, because we preach and we talk a lot about how our marriages are a reflection of Christ and his church. But think about what he's really saying. What Paul's saying is that the world does not understand Jesus and his church. It's a mystery. They don't get it. But they do understand marriage. And when they look at your marriage, they learn something about Christ and the church, and how a groom, a husband, is to treat
is bride and how a bride is to treat her husband. Now for women, he says this. When you yield to leadership in love, knowing that you are representing the church's relationship to Christ, if you disrespect your husband, you show the world that the church has no respect for Christ. If you do not pursue your husband, you show the world that Christ is not worth following. If you sleep around on your husband, you show the world that Christ is not satisfying enough for His people. You see, when we think about our marriage and our commitment, we need to understand how important it is because we are a reflection of Christ and His church. So when we think about proper perspective on commitment, I want to emphasize a couple things. First of all, we often get caught up in the question, did I marry the right person? And I want to encourage those of you who are not married to really think about that. And make sure that you pray about it. Make sure that you have some qualifications and qualities that you're looking for in a spouse. And that you do ask that question, you know, is this the person that's going to be right for me? Is this someone that I can love and whatever, if you're a man or a woman, can I love, can I respect them? And are they going to lead me closer to God? And will they help me get to heaven? But those of us who are married, there's a certain sense where we have made that choice. And we need to be very wary and very careful about constantly asking that question. Did I marry the right person? You see, really what it often comes down to is we get to feeling like we married the wrong person. And we find all the reasons why we should have married somebody different. And then it turns into if we would have married somebody different. And then we often, this is when it really gets dangerous, we even find someone that we wish we would have married. And of course that is ripe for an affair. You see, we're serious about pursuing spiritual growth through marriage. We must convince ourselves to refrain from asking this question. A far better question would be one along this line is, how can I love, how can I bless the marriage that I'm in? How can I enrich it? How can I make it work? You see, it's kind of like a farmer or a gardener. Instead of always asking a question about his ground, and if I had some other soil, if I had some other gardening soil, then I could grow a great garden. Well, he can sit around and fuss all day long about his ground, or he can determine to enrich the soil he has and make it fertile and fertilize it and do things to enrich it. You see, we need to ask the question, how can I bless the one I'm with? You see, it's really about commitment. It's about being faithful to our covenant marriage. Back in Genesis chapter 2, when God ordained marriage, He made a commitment. He instituted it as a commitment between a man and a woman. And it was what the Old Testament called a covenant relationship. And of course, God has instituted two covenants with us. We talk about the Old Covenant and the New Covenant. And when you think about a covenant, and especially in the Old Testament, we see this with Abraham. They would do a covenant when they would go into a covenant with another person. They would even have a ceremony or a ritual where they would slaughter an animal, separate that body of that animal, and then they would pass through that as they signed or declared or initiated this covenant. And the idea is this: if I or you violate that covenant, may what has happened to this animal happen to us. The idea is marriage is a covenant that we're entering into and that we have a responsibility. And Jesus, in the garden, in his teachings in Matthew 19, when he's asked about marriage, goes back to the beginning and he says, Have you not read that God made them male and female? And he talks about this commitment and he quotes from Genesis. And back in Genesis, the Bible would say, beginning in verse 23, that a man said, this is at last bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh, and she should be called woman because she was taken out of man. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and his mother and shall hold fast to his wife. They should cleave and he should be committed to her and they shall become one flesh. And a man and his wife were both naked and were not ashamed. So when we think about commitment, we're thinking that commitment is discovered in the midst of adversity. See, I often tell couples, said Jim Martin, before they marry, that marriage will probably be better than they ever dreamed and more difficult than they ever imagined. Those of us who have been married can appreciate that quote, right? That marriage is something that is a great blessing, but it's also a great challenge. Commitment is discovered in the midst of adversity when you do face challenges and when life throws at you difficult circumstances. That's really when you find out and commitment is needed. Commitment is a result of a choice, not a condition. I remember when I was, I think I've told this story before, but I'll tell it quickly again, that when I was in graduate school, very early on, one of the first classes I took, and I'm not sure we were married yet or not, but I was still learning about marriage for sure and not knowing very much about it, probably about to get married to Amanda. And Dr. Gilmore, who had been married for decades, he made the statement. He said, you know, me and my wife have had some tough times. And he said, there's a lot of times that I thought, you know, if God did not tell me I had to be faithful to her and love her and committed to her, then we just wouldn't stay together. And I was like, here's Dr. Gilmore up there saying that. Man, I respect him so much and been married all this time. And I didn't, you know, I thought, he had a very happy marriage. They had four girls and all these things. And I thought, here he is saying that there's times in his marriage that the reason he stayed faithful to it and the reason he was determined to work on it was because he had made a vow, a commitment to God. And that God's rules, God's law said he had an obligation there and he was not to violate that. And that's what I mean when I say commitment is a result of a choice, not a condition. You know, commitment is when we choose not based upon the environment, but we choose because of our values. When I think about commitment, I can't help but think about several examples. But I think about a military example and about our boys who went ashore on D-Day. And they had made a choice, right? They had made a choice, or their commanders had made a choice, that they were going to attack those beaches. And they had to be fully committed to that, didn't they? You think about the challenge with the guns shooting at them and them having to go. But the thing about it, they had to be committed to it and move forward. They could not retreat. They had to go forward. They had to be committed to it. And the reason they did that was because of their values, because they were fighting for freedom. They were fighting for their country. That's caused them to risk their life out of commitment. Well, when marriage, when we think about marriage, and you and I can think about people, some from our own congregation, who have had to be committed, and maybe a spouse developed Alzheimer's, and it lasted for almost a decade or longer, or have other diseases or problems, or people have had other health issues, or a brain tumor, or something very significant, or an accident, and their marriage relationship changed drastically, but that person was committed to them. Commitment is a result of choice, not a condition, and it's based upon our values. It's based upon the fact that we believe in God and that we're representing Christ to the world. This is why it's so very important for people to marry someone who has similar values, who believes in God, and who has some principles that are similar to you and comes back to that. Well, now let's talk a little bit in the application section on commitment. How can we demonstrate commitment in our marriage? How can we demonstrate it? I have four things here, the ways we can demonstrate commitment in our marriage. First of all, number one, we can demonstrate commitment in our marriage by continuing to learn about marriage. Continuing to educate. Number one, become a student of your spouse. Become a student of your spouse. Always be learning and caring for them. I don't know if you know this or not, but we tell people, and I know you've heard the saying, don't marry someone expecting them to change. And certainly don't marry them thinking you're going to be the one to change them, right? That just leads to a lot of good arguments. But here's the thing we don't often tell people about that. All of us change. All of us change. Men and I be married 16 years in January, and we often talk about how much we have changed as individuals since we got married, and that's only 16 years. And I know you can talk to some of you that have been married 30, 40, 50 years, and you can think back to how different you were as an individual and how different you were as a couple decades ago. And so we change. And so here's the thing, that as we're changing, we need to learn and constantly stay connected. And this is a danger, because what often happens is people change, and if they don't stay connected, they grow apart and they grow different. And one day you wake up and you realize, I don't know the person I'm married to. Sometimes this involves kids, and you get so involved in the life of the kids and the children. And then when the kids leave the home, you got to look at each other and realize, we got to get along with each other without the kids in the home. And so we need to constantly be working on learning one another. And I'll say more about that in the next point too, but how we do that. But on committing to continuing education, let me encourage you from time to time to read some books on it or attend Bible class. We just had a Bible class here recently on marriage, and where we studied on Sunday morning. Sermons like this. Be someone who wants to learn about marriage. There are some great books out there, maybe more books than we've ever had, that are good, sound Christian books on marriage. I recently heard that, haven't read it, it just came out, but Jim Fawn just wrote a book for Bible classes to use on the family and marriage. But there's a lot of books like His Needs, Her Needs, or Five Languages of Love, or Love and Respect, or Sacred Marriage. But there's a lot of good opportunities. Attend seminars, or go to counseling. I was reading about one man, and he said this about counseling. He said, I remember when I went to a therapist for the first time, he said to me, Mike, the healthy people come to me. The people who are really unhealthy won't darken the door of a counselor. So don't think that it is an admission of weakness to go to a counselor, but rather those who are and realize that they need help are the ones who are going to truly be healthy and have the strong, be blessed by it. And so we here provide and will help with counseling. We have resources available. We have some good Christian counselors in our area. Joseph, one of our members of our church, is a Christian counselor. And so we have a lot of blessings that can afford that. And so, commit to education. Number two, commit to enriching your friendship. Commit to enriching your friendship. And remember when I was talking about learning one another and constantly growing? I wanted to say about that, to be best friends and work on becoming best friends. Michael Hyatt, in his blog on this topic, he said, think about the kind of best friend you would want. Wanted best friend, he said. Here's some prospective candidates that would do this. Make me feel good about being me. Affirm my best qualities, especially when I'm feeling insecure. Call out the best in me and hold me accountable to the best version of myself. Listen without judging and trying to fix me. Give me the benefit of the doubt. Extend grace to me when I'm having a bad day. Remember my birthday, my favorite food, or something I like. Know my story and love me. Spend time with me. Speak well of me when I'm not present. Serve me with a joyful spirit and without complaining. Speak the truth to me. Never shame me, diminish me, or make me feel small. And become excited about what I'm excited about and celebrate my wins. And that's a list of things that you would want in a best friend. Those are things that we would want from our spouse. Now, we want those things, and we would want our spouse to be those things. And so what Michael was saying is that that's the kind of person we need to seek to be for our spouse. We need to be a best friend like that. Being best friends involves spending time together. Time and communication are the foods of love. They're the foods of love. That's what helped build us up. If you want to starve love, take away time and communication. That's why it's important for us to spend time talking. Stay connected with one another. This involves dates or couple-only vacation. You know, some people will go for years, and they'll never do a getaway, just them two. I think it's important to get away
Have a break from the children and build time into your life. And make sure you have some time each day to talk to each other. This is what I was talking about earlier, about staying connected and learning what's going on. You know, how was your day and listening and caring? There's all kinds of things you can use. You can just, you know, ask each other about your day. What happened to you and how did you feel about it? And just giving some time. I know some people do this over picking up for supper or, you know, whether it's washing dishes together and you're still talking or connecting or going for a walk or things like that. Here's a key about this. Is be careful and don't allow all of our distractions like TV and internet and those things to keep us from our friendships. The third commitment that I would suggest for us to make in our marriages is commit to following a specific set of boundaries. Commit to following a specific set of boundaries. The opportunity for adultery has never been greater. The opportunity for adultery has never been greater. In fact, sexual sins and all the temptations out there are great. And so I want to suggest four boundaries that I think we as Christians should have. Number one, some of these may seem kind of basic. And you might, these are not necessarily biblical. And so I'm not going to say they are, you know, truth in that sense. But these are good ideas or suggestions, and you might have to modify them. But I think these are wise things that would keep us from temptation. Number one, don't go eat alone with someone of the opposite sex. Now, there seems to me a general good rule there that you're not going to go out and eat alone with someone of the opposite sex. That both of you are going to have this as a boundary. That you're not going to go there because of the appearance of that and because of the temptation that could be there. So keeping that boundary up. Number two, and this goes right along with that, don't travel alone with someone of the opposite sex. Don't travel alone. How many people have started out, and often it might come through a business connection, but they begin by traveling together and they feel like they do that just because it works well with the business situation. But that time together and that communication together, that environment leads to problems. Number three, don't flirt. Now this is so important. Don't flirt with someone else of the opposite sex. Men especially, those of us who are well beyond the age of college, we need to make sure we have this as a boundary, because we can have our ego stroked when a younger woman flirts with us or pays us some kind of attention. And we need to be very careful about that and make sure that if that happens at the workplace, if that happens in some type of environment we're in, that we are very quick to let them. And you can usually end those things pretty quickly by bringing up your wife in the conversation, bringing up your children, bringing up something to make sure that that person understands and knows that you're a married man or woman. And so don't flirt. And I know at the in the factories and places like that, flirting can be just kind of the way of life. And I tell you, us as Christians should be above that. There's no place for that kind of conduct in the life of a married Christian. And number four, don't keep, and this is very, very important, don't keep your online and phone life private from your spouse. Now, that ought to be understood, but I tell you, so many affairs, so many problems get started through text messaging and through things that go on in what I'm calling our online life, our social media life, Facebook and Twitter and all these kind of things. And your phone, if you're married, is not your private device, right? Your spouse has a right to that. And here's the thing. Why would you ever care unless you're doing something you shouldn't be doing? Except for Christmas and birthday time, they need to have access to everything in your life. And you should not be concerned about. You should not be concerned about a text coming in or an email coming in, or
And this seems absurd to me, but there are a lot of people that maybe not even will allow their spouse to be their friend with them on Facebook, but they're married to them in real life. Or they do not know or have access to any of their passwords or their private email settings and things of that nature. I think that's very dangerous. Four boundaries. Don't go eat alone. Don't travel alone. Don't flirt with someone of the opposite sex. And don't keep your online life private from your spouse.
You all know, if you've visited and talked to people, that last one, you know that people that fall to temptation, and any of us can fall to temptation, it usually is because one of those boundaries, and maybe even that last one is the most common one, is not observed in that relationship. And here's the thing, none of us are above this.
All of us need to make sure we have these boundaries up in our life. This is what I believe the Bible talks about when it says, flee fornication. Run from it. Do not put yourself in the position where you can be tempted. So have these boundaries so that you can flee fornication, as Paul talks about in 1 Corinthians 6.
The final commitment I would suggest us making is committing to speaking well of your spouse. Committing to speaking well of your spouse. In Ephesians chapter 4, right before talking about marriage and the relationship between Christ and the church, Paul would say in verses 29 through 31, "Let no corrupting talk come out of your mouths, but only such as is good for building up as fits the occasion, that it may give grace to those who hear." Paul talks about this, not allowing corrupting talk coming out of your mouths, but allowing good and edifying things. He says, verse 31, "Let all bitterness and wrath and anger and clamor and slander be put away from you, and be kind to one another." In our homes, one of the best things we can do is speak well of one another. And especially speak well of them in public and to other people. So speak well of your spouse. There's a few things that one resource shared from Michael Hyde as well, where I got some of this information. He shared some reasons to do that. Number one, he says, because you're going to get more out of what you affirm. And he says, now I'm not trying to be manipulative here, and we shouldn't just treat it like this. I'm going to praise them so they'll give me some love back. But he says that it is true that if we brag and we are sincere in our appreciation and we speak well of our spouse, then it's going to encourage our spouse. And they're going to be more likely in encouraging him in doing those things. But then number two, he says, and this is very important, affirmation shifts your attitude towards your spouse. Instead of always focusing on the negative, when you affirm them, it causes you to look at the good things of their life and focus on the positive. Affirmation helps strengthen your spouse's best qualities. That's very similar to number one. But it helps encourage them in what they're doing. And then affirmation wards off the temptation of adultery. It helps in warding off the temptation when he's coming from the perspective of when you're talking to other people. I won't forget Neil Pryor telling the story one time when he was talking about on this subject, how he had gone to preach somewhere and he was flying home. He was flying home and he said that when he was flying home, there was a gentleman there who was noticeably very affectionate with this young lady, and they were giggling and flirting all through the time, and they had been on some kind of getaway together. And he said that he thought, you know, they were just a couple. And he said that when they got off at the airport and they went away, he noticed that she stayed back. And he went out, and there at the airport, there to greet him, was his wife and kids. He thought, how sad. How sad is this that he's got this private life going on, involved with this other woman, and yet his family is unaware of it. And he knew that ultimately that's like a train wreck. Ultimately, it's going to come into a great collision. But here's the thing, the point I'm making with this. Do you think he said anything positive about his wife? Talked highly about her when he was with that other woman?
What about when they first begun that? Or whenever their flirtation started? What if he would have talked about his wife and let it be known very early? He has a wife that he's proud of and that he loves. And he has kids that he loves. You see, that's going to be an immediate buffer. It's going to be an immediate thing that's going to ward off the adultery. And so we need to commit to speaking well of our spouse. Whenever we get in situations where we're speaking to especially someone of the opposite sex, all the problems of our spouse, and we're confiding in them, and we're finding encouragement in them, we need to be very careful, because that's not a wise situation, but a very dangerous situation. And so affirmation provides, finally, a model to those you lead. It encourages and gives a model for them. When we think about commitment in marriage, we've talked about a lot of things, but I hope this has been practical and good, and I hope it's challenged all of us to be more committed in our marriage, to be faithful to the one that we're married to, and to our covenant relationship in God. We have a responsibility to God. We made a commitment, and we must represent this type of lifelong, loyal commitment to the world as Christians. You know, I think that Christians, if we're going to change the world's perspective on marriage, we do it by setting strong examples of godly marriages who represent Christ in the church and who are committed to each other through thick and thin. If you are here this evening and you're not a child of God, I want to encourage you to put Christ on in baptism. If you need to rededicate your life, come as together we stand and sing.
Marvelous grace of our loving Lord, grace that exceeds our sin and our guilt, yonder on Calvary's mount outpoured, there where the blood of the Lamb was spilled. Grace, grace, God's grace, grace that will pardon and cleanse.